Excision number 11938, reel 43.
Mr. G. Iston, reel 43. Were there many accidents?
No, I can't recall any accidents. And when you're thinking about this Tokra Pass, which I just mentioned, this was a pass actually dug into the rock of the mountain. On one side, as you went down, there was nothing. Just a sheer drop, and then you would curve around the mountain a bit and come back underneath where you just come from. A really serious place, I suppose. It was something like 5 miles, I don't know, might have been more, but I'll think about 5 miles in length. But he just wandered in the same wadi, where it's not a wadi, it's too big for a wadi, it's too steep for a wadi. I suppose if anything it was a waterfall. If there had been rain, it would be a waterfall, because he just seemed to go around it, and then he turned around and go back underneath it again, all the way down. It wasn't really a corkscrew. Well, I suppose it could be a corkscrew. He just seemed to go underneath the road he'd just been on, all the way down, for about 5 miles, and nothing on the side at all, on the one side, depending which way you're going. I mean, if you're... it might be that you've got the stone on your left-hand side, and then you go around the corner and start to come back again, you've got the stone on your right-hand side, so you go around until you start to come round again. No, it was serious, just like Cyprus. Getting down the pass, we came to the little village of Tokra. A nice little village, much like the rest of the villages, but Tokra, as opposed to Barchi was on the top of the ridge. Tokra was on the seaside, and on the seaside there was the odd garden, but not the villages having the same appeal as these had in the mountains. I suppose it's the same in most countries, where you've got villages in the mountains, they've always got a certain appeal because the mountains are there and the sea is away. You can very often see it, but it's not interfering with it. When I got down to Tokra, the sea was almost on the side of the road. And then through Benghazi, we skirted Benghazi. We went through part of Benghazi, but not through the centre of Benghazi, because by then the port was becoming to come on stream again. And naturally they wanted to keep us away from the port road as far as possible. So we skirted Benghazi and then to Adjidabia, and then Brega and El Agheila. And that is generally where we stopped. But occasionally we would go up a bit further to Sirte, because the battalion, the next battle was going to be at Burat.
Was there any signs along this long journey of battle that had gone on before?
Not close to the road, but occasionally you would see the hook of a tank in the distance. Because once you leave Benghazi, you come back to desert, more or less. You've got the sea on your right, the road is quite close to the sea. But you've got the desert on your right, and that desert goes right through to the spot I tried to describe at Masseuse. It never gets above 600 feet, and it goes right away through to Tobruk, in fact, at this very low level, and it's desert all the way. Occasionally it gets below sea level, but you never get more than 600 feet in height. Once you've left northern Cyrenaica, but the north, it is quite high. I think it goes to about 1500 feet, close to the coast. It's a daft thing, really, that all the way along Africa you've got this high land close to the coast, and then it drops away down to 0 feet, and then it goes up again as it gets further down. But it, you know, all across the centre of northern Africa you've got this place which is more or less down to sea level. And you've got desert all the way through then, right until you get into the Tripolitania. Now, on the... We did this for 5 weeks, and then we had another spell of training, again with 50th Royal Tanks.
You rejoined the battalion.
And
they were still at Benina.
And the carriers had gone right on. They'd stayed with their transports, and they'd gone right on to Burat and... now what do they call that place? Ben Gadin. And that is where the main dump was being formed for the Battle of Burat, which was going to be held at Burat. And they'd gone straight ahead. In fact, they were at one stage, they were set out to guard this big dump in case there was any attack on it. I think I had quite a good time, actually. There was a spell when they were left in the lurch, and Maurice Kirby went through and sorted it out, I believe. But I was with the battalion. I hadn't gone on with the transporters. I was with the battalion. And we got back and we started doing more training. On the 2nd of March, we set off again along the coast road to Gamines, and then along the coast. The coast road goes right against the coast now, right round the Gulf of El Agheila and something. Yeah, the Gulf of El Agheila. The coast road is within sight of the sea all the way. In fact, you could almost put your hand out. It's just a few sand dunes, and you're in the sea. But the villages, they're coming on now. There's one or two with date palms in, and the odd apricot, and a little bit more activity now, because I think a lot of the old farmers, they decided they were going to stay back and carry on with what they were doing. Of course, they'd never been invaded before, not round the after El Agheila, they'd never been invaded. So they decided, I think, they were going to stay. Yeah, we carried on up through El Agheila and Ras. 81 miles that day. That's not bad, really, for a big convoy to be travelling through. The following day, the 5th of March, we went through the Marble Arch. Through the Marble Arch and into Tripolitania. Now, the Marble Arch, it looks a bit like the Marble Arch, or a miniature Marble Arch. It's just one arch. A white thing, you can see it from miles away. The road is straight. I suppose it is two cars width in the arch. I don't think you get two wagons through, you might. It's high. It had, Pax, Mussolini, Pax, something, I just forget now. But it's in the middle of nowhere, it's in the middle of a desert, crossing a road. It does nothing, it says nothing, it's not even on the entrance to Tripolitania. But it's one of Mussolini's monuments, and these were all over. Now, I must say that these houses in the Cyrenaica, they were white, but they all had on deuce, there's a longish word, deuce commiserat, or something like that it was. Deuce. Anyway, it was a motto for Mussolini.
This was on every one of the houses?
More or less on every one of the houses, yes. There was no flags. We didn't see any flags. I think we did see two. Two, I believe, we saw.
And these would be people who'd never had any problems with the war till now.
No.
And were the relationships still good if you moved through them?
Well, at this stage, we didn't really get a chance to find out. Because now I was with the convoy, we weren't the 20 of us travelling on our own where we could sort of decide ourselves where we were going to stop. Now with the convoy, I said I'd had to put my three-wheeler into a truck. I had got it out again by this stage, and I was allowed a fair bit of freedom. but not really that I could wander off into a village or anything like that. And the staging areas were outside, probably deliberately outside, sometimes only 4 miles out, so you could run back if you wanted to, in a sense. But there was always so much work to be done that it never did happen.
So that when you pulled up, your job then was really starting?
That's right, yes. For all you'd driven all day, you were just starting then.
What time of day would this, what might this be?
Well, generally dusk, pulling in. Now, one day we only did 25 miles. I don't really know why, but there was one day that we only did 25 miles. Whether that was intention for maybe to get a bit of cleaning done, or you know, to get some washing done, because there was still a fair amount of dust for all we're travelling on the road at this stage. There's still a fair amount of dust flying around, and there was one occasion where we just had a big draft in. After we'd left Alamein, we had another draft came in, and they got caught up in a cam sheen. I forget where it was now. But they'd seen nothing like it before. And well, I mean, when you get caught in a cam sheen, where you've got this hot sand blowing in your face all the time, it's getting in your mouth, in your teeth, behind your tongue.
What problems is that? Mean for the trucks themselves with this sand blowing in?
Well, they are fairly well fitted for keeping sand out. They've got cleaners on wherever it is possible, especially the army vehicles, the British Army vehicles, because they're used to India, you see, and they were pretty well equipped. But there was one or two that we had difficulties with. But this made a lot more work for us on a night, because it meant that a lot of air cleaners had to be cleaned out. We had the occasional pump, the petrol pump had to be cleaned out. The filters had to be cleaned fairly regular to get over this sand situation. So that meant a lot of work for us. Now, there was an incident just somewhere along here. I don't know where it was exactly. It might have been on the way to Benina. Probably was, I think, where we had a soaking in the rain. And I developed a carbuncle on my right hip, the top of the pelvis on the right hip. And it was rubbing like mad against the seat. Every time the truck bounced, it was rubbing against the seat. And I remember getting on the morning. Yes, it must have been when we were bogged down. It was getting on the morning when I got into the battalion. And I went and woke the MO up to see if he could do anything about it. He did something all right. He just lanced it and put a bit of strapping over it and sent me back. Well, he didn't exactly send me back. I mean, I was going back in any case, but he was great. He eased the situation quite a lump. He gave me some painkillers.
Do you remember his name?
It wasn't Joy. I think it was something like Gibson, I'm not sure now. Now, I don't remember quite on it. I think it was, could have easily been Gibson. But he was a great fella. I got on very well with the MOs for some reason. All of them. I did very well with them. But this one really saved the situation, because, oh, I was in some agony. I mean, I had about 5 or 6 days, I think, driving with this thing nagging away. I thought it was just a little boil at first, you see, and a boil very often, you can give them a nip and it squeezes out. But this wasn't. Oh, it got the size of the bottom of a bottle. It was a nasty thing. It was a carbuncle, he said, anyway. He's so quiet in that town. He got the knife out. For all he was in the middle of the night, he was in his kip. He settled that all right. These demos were marvellous people, you see. They were on their own. And I suppose they weren't accountable to anybody, really. I mean, they did as they saw fit, in a sense. If there was a leg to be taken off, it came off. But, I mean, mine was a simple one of a carbuncle. He just knifed it and that was it. But on the other hand, I mean, they had to do it. There was nobody else, except for the medical orderlies. They were the only people who could help him. And they had to make their own decisions, and great people they were, most of them.
Was the health of the battalion after such a long journey still pretty high?
It was. We got used to all these sort of things now, and I suppose the desert sores are a thing that you get immune to in time. I don't recall a lot of desert sores later on in the North African campaign. Earlier on, we did have quite a lot. When we were in the south, when we were in Egypt, more or less, we had quite a few. But I don't think we had them so much when we got further west. Now, whether this is something to do with the climate, where we're nearer the sea, and not so much sand floating around, or it was that we got immune to it, I don't know. But certainly, I don't think we were quite as much then as we had further back. Anyway, we got through the Marble Arch and into Tripolitania, and we spent the night in the Wadi Zirgan. And the following day, we went to Sirte, or 20 miles west of Sirte, through Sirte and 20 miles west. Sirte was quite a pretty little place, a little fishing village, I would think, really. We just sort of skirted, you see. All these villages go to the sea, and the road is back from the sea naturally, because it can't be that close to the sea. But we just skirted it, but it did seem quite a nice little village. We did 102 miles up there, which is pretty good going for a battalion convoy. On the Sunday, we got to Burat, where the battle had been fought just a few weeks earlier. And a few days earlier, actually. And then we went down the desert track south. I don't know why we came off the coast road there. Possibly it hadn't been mocked up or something. But we went off the coast and onto the desert track. And then that's where the Kamshin came up, when we hit the desert track. And that's where the rookies got inoculated to the Kamshin. That day wasn't too good. It was only about 90 miles, I think. And the next day, we went west on the track, and then we came north again to Bir Dufain, and we stopped there. We did 110 miles that day on the desert, on the coast road. Now, why we left the coast road, I don't know. I can only assume that the battle was still not completely over. We were on our way to, we didn't know it then, of course, but we were on our way to Marath, which was still another, something like 300 miles, I think, from where we were now.
When you, just to go back briefly to Alamein, had any of the men or officers, NCOs, received awards for Alamein that you know of?
Yes. Yes. Sergeant Aisley, Sergeant Dunn, Page, I think, got a MC on the. And I think he got something else. I can't recall them from memory, but there were quite a few awards.
When awards are given to someone like this in an action, which everyone is in, is there any envy or muttering that someone gets selected, you might say, for an award?
There's always a feeling that to get an award, you've got to be in the right place at the right time. I suppose you've got to be seen by the right people at the right time. There is a difficulty with senior ranks, very senior ranks, that very often they're the senior ones and they can't put themselves forward. Well, basically, yes, there is a feeling that any award really is part of the regiment. And it just happens that you're the person that received the award because you were at the right place at the right time. But really, the award is part of the regiment. It's something the regiment's been awarded. And I think that goes. I don't think there's any envy. I can think of a lot of lads who I'd have thought should have had awards. Reggie Jeffries, I've said many times, I think he should have been a VC. But he happened to be the senior man at the time, so there was nobody to put him forward. There was nobody there to senior to put him forward. And it seems a great shame to me that this is the situation. That, well, I suppose it's a matter of pride on the part of the senior person there, isn't it? If he's the senior man, he doesn't like putting himself forward for an award. I suppose this is the situation. But Colonel Jeffries, for me, I mean, he was a VC if ever there was a man, because he saved a lot of lives on at Arras. And I believe he did afterwards as well. I believe Colonel Watson should have been awarded. He did some terrific work with division before he came back to the battalion. There was a spell in while I was in Cairo. I don't know why he spent so much time in Cairo, but I suppose it was what he was told to do. But having said that, I certainly think he did some good planning. And he always, there was a story of the one battle that, I forget which one it was now, I rather think it was the one at El Alamein where we did the right wheel, that he planned it on a cricket field, watching a cricket match down there in the Delta when he was being sent back sick. I think it was the Alamein one. And he always tells the story that he planned that one there. He worked a treat. It was a new manoeuvre as far as the army was concerned, to do a right wheel on in the battlefield. I suppose somebody did the same thing on the south, I don't know, in the other brigade. Was certainly, from the experience of the Battiscombe escapade, where they were taken from the rear eventually, it worked, and it worked well. And he always tells the story that what, I think it was that one that was planned on the cricket field, what's a cricket match in the Delta. So, yes, I would not say there was envy anywhere, but it was always felt that you had to be in the right place at the right time. And
how important are the characters in a battalion for keeping up morale? This was a horrendous journey, really, from Alamein right up to Marrakesh, ultimately. It must have been extremely tiring, quite boring.
Yeah. I suppose, as I explained about the RSM, unfortunately he wasn't with us now when he knew RSM Watt, I think it was. I think they called him Watt from C Company. One of the crook companies, anyway. They are the people who the old sweats. They can come out with some real stinkers at times when everybody's feeling just a little bit jaded, and they say, well, when I was in Pune, so and so, and you get the road from Mandalay or something like that. You tell him what to do with the road from Mandalay. I suppose, really speaking, that in an army in battle, there is no, I was going to say deceit, but deceit isn't the word. There's an openness. And from the officer down to the private, there's a job to do. And everybody knows that job's to do. And if they can make it easy for their mates, or the mate can make it easy for them, it'll be done. It's pretty decoy, it is. A stupid word for what it is, but I suppose it does say it's a esprit de corps, one looking after another. And if you know somebody's low, you go down and throw a bit of bad language into him, and it's amazing what that does. There is a tendency in bad times for people to go within themselves. They shut up. And once you see this shutting up happening, that is the time to get in and literally thump them. If you think a thump will do them good, thump them. There was one sergeant major, Sergeant Major Howson came from Barnacastle as well, Big Jim. He, if he saw somebody standing with his shoulders down, head down, he'd just go up beside him and he'd swing his arms out and he'd crack him back and front on the chest. And this, of course, is the same thing that they use today for the defibrillator, to make the heart go into beat. Now, that causes a terrific pain when the heart is working and somebody thumps you on the heart, back and front. I mean, if you do first aid, you're taught to put somebody on a hard floor and give the heart a thump if it stopped, only if it stopped. But when you do that when the heart's working, oh, it causes terrific pain. And of course, that pain makes you forget any other worries you've got, doesn't it? And he used to do this quite regularly. I didn't realise what he was doing for a while. And I used to see him going around and giving these blokes a thump, and you could see them fall down. Because, oh, the pain is really excruciating. He did it with me in play a couple of times. In play, you know, there'd been arguing, he's doing it in play. But I've seen him do this with people with their heads down and not being the best of spirits. And he's just gone in and given them a thump. And of course, the pain, forget about what the other worries that were then. And then he'll probably send him a beer in or something like that to make the peace again. He was a marvellous people. Marvellous.
Very popular.
Well, when people got to know what he was doing, yes, he was very popular. He was a popular bloke. In fact, I think, really speaking, that most of the CSMs were in this sense. You've got the same thing as the RSM, you see. They're the disciplinarians of the company. But people realise that that is their job, and all right, there's bad words now and again, but I think, in generally speaking, that the soldier takes it, that, okay, I've done something wrong, he's told me, or he's charged me, or whatever it is, and the soldier accepts it eventually.
Were there any particular other ranks who stand out as being a great help with morale?
Well, I think any mates, and I suppose I was fortunate that I had mates throughout the battalion, because with being looking after their vehicles, I could be out in A Company one morning, I could be out with C Company afternoon, I could be a support company at night. So I got to know most people, and more people knew me than I knew them. Because I used to be around the battalion, I suppose, almost as much as the CO was. And, yes, if I was feeling down the dumps, somebody would say, "What's the matter with you today?" And we'd have a few sharp words, and a few sharp words, you forgot what your troubles are. There was times where I had to lay the law down a bit, when I thought somebody hadn't been doing the maintenance properly, or they were doing something which wasn't really good for the vehicle.
Were you holding any rank at this time?
This time, no. No, I didn't have any rank, but I was a fitter, which did sort of give me some rank as far as any maintenance or things like that goes. Yes, I had a rank. But as far as discipline went, not really. I couldn't make 252s. I could put people on a charge if I wanted. But I never did. I wasn't so much a disciplinarian as that, I'm afraid. It might have been better if I had been, but no, I had rank. And I suppose I'd, can I say a personality, which is a rank in a sense, a great rank, really. And I suppose I had personality. I was well liked, I think. I don't recall of any enemies. No doubt I would have one or two, but where I'd stepped on people's toes. I think, yes, I had a rank, but no. I had nothing on my arms apart from my hammer and tongs. I was made up very soon after this. I think it was just before Marath It was about this period, actually, that I was made up to Lance Corporal. And the little tale with that was that Colonel Watson, I went into the office in the morning, and he made me a Lance Corporal. And in the afternoon, I was riding along on the motorbike and went past him, and I had my fore and after on the side, and he told me to forget I'd been made a Lance Corporal. He didn't cancel it in all, is it, unfortunately, and I did put the stripe up eventually, but I left the stripe off for a few weeks, and then he asked me why I hadn't got the stripe on then. So I told him, you told me to take it off before I got it stitched on. Just one of the things, just the type of man he was. He'd complain about something and then ask you why he hadn't done what he complained about.